So we're going to look at values this morning. A very, very big and key area of NLP, especially at the master practitioner level, is values. A real window into what's going on with somebody, a real insight into their personality. And I think we ought to start off by looking at, firstly, what values are, where they come from, and what they do for us. Why would we want to learn them in the first place, I guess is the first question. Well, firstly, from a personal point of view, they tell you how you spend time. Ultimately, you as a person unconsciously are always seeking to fulfill your values. And at the highest end of that would be you're seeking to fulfill your needs, which are values, super values, you might call those, for example, that everybody has to meet. So whenever you have an opportunity to do something, then it's your values that you go to make that decision. So that's why it's useful to know, because you may have some values that are disempowering, as in they're not useful and not necessarily supporting where you want to go in your life. Say, hey, listen, look, if you make a goal or an outcome to achieve something great, and you don't have values that are going to support the behaviors that you're going to need to do in order for you to carry out that result, then clearly you're going to, at some level, begin to start sabotaging yourself, or at least not give it your full, or indeed come up against some kind of block at some point if it goes against the values that you have. So it's really important to understand it. That's one reason from a personal point of view. Here's another reason why I think it would be useful for you to know them as well. From a relationship point of view, I think it would be really valuable for you to know what your values are and to know what your partner's values are too. Because, like, is it possible, more likely, is it probable, that in fact your partner's values are likely to be quite different to yours? Is that at least possible, do you think? Yeah, it's probably highly probable. Because you don't kind of get together with somebody and go, oh, just give me a second. What's important to you about life? And what else is important to you? And why is that important? You know, you don't kind of do that. You kind of just fall into relationships. And of course, then you have a challenge with how you spend time together when you're being together, because you want to do one thing, and that's the last thing they want to do. You want to do something else, completely different. Now, of course, what's going to happen in that situation, of course, is ultimately one or two things are going to happen. Either you're going to exit the relationship and it's not going to work, or one of you is going to compromise who you are and make decisions about things that you don't really want to do. At the end of life, causing you pain and anguish, and maybe even causing you some kind of physical situation in your life because you haven't yet enforced a boundary, because you're not really being who you are, if you like. So I think it's really important to know that. So, you know, in a simple example, I think you may have heard before, but, you know, if one of your highest values on your list is, say, adventure, and the number one list on the list of your partner, for example, is security, are you likely to run into some challenges? Yes, definitely. And what's interesting is, whilst there's conflict there inside you and somebody else, what's even more interesting is you may have that same conflict running inside of you. As you may have towards values to do one thing, but away from values that are in conflict with your towards values. So you feel like you're pulled apart. There might be a clue there in what might happen to you. Pulled apart, yes? So you might generate a part inside of you, as in you behave this way one way and some way another way, and start to fragment yourself and start to become anything less than whole. And that's when we start to feel a bit out of sorts, don't know who we are. People can't also predict you because you behave differently in different situations depending on what's running at that point in time. whether your fear's running and you do X, or whether you're not, your fear's not running, you do Y. Ultimately, you want to be able to do the same thing each time. So we're looking here to see if we can get your values aligned with who you want to be and who you need to be in order to get the results you want in your life. Most people pay no attention to this at all. And when your client comes in, they're going to have issues within their values. Otherwise, they wouldn't be showing up. So again, it's another tool, another way in. And I think if you're going to become outstanding at the C meaning therapy technique that I've developed, then you need to really, really be good at the values. C meaning therapy won't work at all unless you are outstanding at learning how to elicit values, understand values, and see how they apply to this person. So I'll be doing a demonstration of C meaning therapy with one of you for you to get that insight. And we'll also be doing a values elicitation, and you'll be doing the exercise on that today as well. But I think you can agree there are lots of reasons why we'd want to learn this and really pay attention. So what are values then? So where do they come from? What are they? And, let's have an example of those. So if you were to value something, what are some things that you value? Because in life, basically what's happened is, based on your life experiences, you've come to value certain things as being important to you. And what you do is, firstly, I've said, you decide what you're going to do. If you have a decision to make, for example, you decide upon it at an unconscious level based on your values. And you have a hierarchy inside of yourself. This is what we call the criteria, the hierarchy of criteria or values inside yourself. And you tend to go with your dominant values, the ones that are the highest and the least value, the ones that are least on your list, for example, less so. So they decide how you spend time up front. But it's also interesting that they also become your after-the-event evaluation as well. So after you've done something, what you do is you look for your values to evaluate your performance, or you evaluate how you've spent the time as well, and you see your values to see, did that work for me, for example? And of course, you're also evaluating other people based on your own values as well. So they become both a motivation and a drive and a push, but also an evaluation after the fact as well. So what are some things that you've come to value in life? What's some things you've come to value? Just shout a few things out. What have you come to value in life? Second? Freedom important to you, yes. Okay, let's just make a quick list of these. So we've got freedom, loyalty. Skills, okay, so skills stroke knowledge, yes, that makes sense, yeah. Love we have, good. Integrity, security, adventure, honesty, honor. So again? Timeless. Kindness, beg your pardon, thank you. Kindness. Children. Justice. Health, was that what you said, rather than help? Big problem. Music. Okay, we'll stop there for a moment. So we've got quite an extensive list there. So I guess the first question is, how come we've got so many people with so many different things that they value? That's the first question. How come? Because their life experiences have been different. That's true. So where do our values come from? Well, we talk about them coming from lots of different places. We talk about them coming from, our families, school, religion, our teachers, parents, our friends. Loads of different things there influence our values. And ultimately, though, it is the experience you have with those people that actually determines your values, things that you value in life. Now, I think it's worth some, we'll come back to that one in a second. I think it's worth some quick looking at the sort of history of values in general as opposed to individuals first. So let's have a look at that. I also want to create some connection here just briefly between beliefs, values, and attitudes for you as well. So you can think of it like this. Say these are values, okay, things that are important to you. What come off of your values are beliefs. Beliefs, what are they? Well, here's what it is. It's a specific type of belief, but let's say you have a value here. Let's say the value you have is love. Say this value here is love. Will you have beliefs around love, yes or no? Yes. The beliefs that you'll specifically have around love will be things like, what has to, here's a simple belief, what has to happen outside of me for me to notice it? Does that make sense? So you have rules about what has to happen in order for you to give yourself permission to feel love. You don't know what they are, they're just there. You've unconsciously written them at some point. These are your rules, yeah? So think of these beliefs stroke rules. There are certain things that have to be in place in order for love to be experienced by you. Let's do another one. So same thing. Let's have here anger. Again, you have beliefs about what has to happen outside of you in order for you to give yourself permission to run anger in your system, to piss yourself off. Okay? Now, here's the thing. Most people in life have challenges because of the way they've set the system up unconsciously. When I say they set the system up, I don't mean you consciously chose this. I just mean at some level, based on the experiences you've had, based on the meanings you've created out of those experiences, you've probably done this. You made the rules for love difficult to meet. As in, there are lots of them that all have to be lined up in one place before you'll give yourself the permission. But the rules for feeling angry, they're pretty easy to meet. As in, there's only one or two things have to happen, and then it runs. Does that make sense? So the next question becomes, why? The next question becomes, why? How come? Because at some level, this serves you more than this. The only reason you'd set the rules up for being angry more often than being loved more often is at some level this is a safer emotion perhaps to display than this one. Perhaps. That's just one example of perhaps how it might be. But at some level, this here, there's more risk perhaps involved here than there is here potentially. So what you've done is you've if we go back to our what the bleep do we know, what we're saying is you have an addiction to run this, but you don't have an addiction to run this. Because this one at some level serves you more than this one. Or at least that's what you believe based on what's happened. So what happens is, for example, let's give you a typical example. Let's say you're feeling very uncertain and you're feeling very insignificant. Is that going to happen to you at some time in life, perhaps at least once a day, at least, perhaps? Yes or no? Yeah. You're uncertain and feel a bit insignificant, right? So, if you feel uncertain and insignificant, you could choose to go here to restore your feeling of significance and your feeling of certainty. You could. But most people will go here because that's where they've wired themselves to go. Because listen, if you feel uncertain and you feel insignificant, if you get very angry, can it give you at least the illusion of restoring your certainty and restoring your sense of significance? Yes or no? Yes, definitely. So you've just made a limiting choice about how to behave, only because it works. So you've just learned that that worked. At some level, one day, for whatever reason, you got angry and you got, and what happens, it did restore your sense of certainty and did make you feel more significant. And what happens is your unconscious mind records that. Again, you create more receptor sites on the cells for that. And so that pattern then starts to happen. It starts to run more often. Now, I've given you one example, but we could run sadness here, for example. We could run the joker here, for example. We could run the placator here, for example. We could run the blamer here, for example. All sorts of these things are running. So let's give you a big overview of how these tie up. So think of beliefs as the rules, what has to happen in order for me to feel it. And again, all these come from experience. You've had an experience in the past, and then you create the beliefs off of the value. The value comes first. Now, the question from Tim was, are these things connected? Yes. What connects these things all together is you have collections of values and beliefs which are connected, and we call those attitudes. So certain attitudes that you have towards certain things are collections of values and beliefs. That's what you'd loosely term an attitude. Does that make sense to you? Follow me so far? Is you enjoying this? Good. Excellent. So let's have a quick look from Morris Massey. Have a look at some of the developmental periods in your life where values could be created. So we've got from the 0 to 7 years old is what we'd call the imprint period. Our imprint period. Do I have a slide for this? Your imprint period, which is basically where you're imprinting upon your parents and your significant people in your life. Meaning you pick up all of their projections because you don't really have a conscious mind. It's only just starting to develop your reasoning faculty. Think about your critical faculty. Think about your conscious mind, your reasoning. Think about that as a filter like this that you hold all around you. So when you have a conscious mind and that thing, what happens? It allows you to block things out. It allows you to not allow it in. You can choose to reject it, for example. But when, of course, you're young, that hasn't formulated yet. The rules of life of what you believe is actually haven't really started forming, so you're open. So there is no real filter there at all. So everything goes in and is believed, which is why you can have a child believe in Father Christmas, for example. But he is real, though, isn't he? Yeah. And fairies at the bottom of the garden and things like that, because they just imprint upon their parents and just don't have a way of any references to reject it. So that's a very critical time in our lives, because it's where a lot of our personality is formed from early in life. And certainly, many people's deepest wounds, their psychic wound, can often be created early on at this time. They may not have any perception of that because it may be so imperceptible and they didn't have any real SEEs, as in any significant emotional events at that time. It may not have been till much later that they got a really big significant emotional event. But the reason that they weren't able to deal with that significant emotional event, or even possibly the reason why they manifested or created it, was as a direct result of how the system was set up between 0 and 7. There may not a significant emotional event may not run or happen during that time. It may just be small little things that are imperceptible, like just being ignored a little bit by your parents, for example, or little events, and then you get a big whammy event when you're like 14, for example. But basically, because how the system was set up when you're much older means that your nervous system isn't able to handle it. You make very disempowering meanings out of it, etc. And that's where the biggest boom comes at that point. But just know that the foundations for that may have been set up much earlier than that. Does you follow that? Does that make sense? Yeah? So then we move from 7 to 14 into what we call our modelling period. That's where we start to really model people. So we start to consciously start to choose people to model to be like. So we start to really look for into our parents, for example. And we start to see the whole big picture unconsciously. So we start to model them as role models for love, for example. So boys start to look towards their father to see how to behave around women and how to be a man between ages of 7 and 14 starts to happen. Same thing for ladies, start to look to their mum as, you know, what is this lady thing about? What is this being a female about? How do I do it? Look outside of yourself for those role models to actually start to model it in yourself. Which is, you know, again, why often we end up manifesting relationships that are like our mum and dad's relationships, for example. So, you know, if you have a role model of a father in a certain way, then, you know, you may end up, you know, for ladies, for example, because your role model of who a man is, the man you want to be loved by, because the man you love the most first will be your father, if he's your father's around. So oftentimes we end up, you know, looking for someone who's like our father, because we lose that, you know, once we move away from our father, you know, when we move on, we lose that sense of unconditional love, and that's what we're searching for in a man. You're searching again for that source of infinite love around us. Now, of course, if that love isn't there to begin with, then again, we begin to come into more difficulties. So if that love wasn't there initially, then what do we have to do? Well, we have to find ways as a youngster to compromise that, ways of getting that love in other ways. So again, you know, doing things to please others, for example. So, you know, let's say your father was around, but he wasn't giving it unconditional love. Then maybe what you decided to do, for example, was to try and please him by being the best at something. You know, because he didn't know how to treat you as a lady, as a young lady, for example. So because his mindset as a man, he didn't know how to bring you up as a little girl. So, you know, he treated you like a little boy, for example. So you started to achieve, for example, was one of the things you did. And maybe you're still doing that now because your highly prized and valued criteria is knowledge, for example, because that's what your father taught you, perhaps. And similarly for ladies, you know, modeling their mum, for example. You know, if mum was the one who wore the trousers in the house, then that's what you kind of end up doing. You know, you kind of end up searching for that sense of certainty yourself rather than giving yourself the gift of allowing your man, for example, to come along and give you that sense of certainty and be your rock for you. What you do is you feel uncomfortable with anybody that has that level of certainty because it scares you a little bit. So what you do is you have no reference for it. You don't even see it because your role model of a father, someone you want to have that unconditional love was somebody perhaps that was a wet dishcloth that stayed in the background, for example, or let's say he was completely aloof and not around. Or didn't know how to connect with you, so you have no reference for it. You just modelled your mum entirely, and she was one that was really certain. And as you adopt that same certainty model yourself, and then you end up finding a partner that's, you know, that's just completely dissociated, perhaps, or someone that you can boss around, or someone you can have as a butler, for example. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And then we move on to our socialisation period, 14 to 21. And here, what we do, it's still modelling. But we start to model outside the family now. So we start to look for role models outside the family to expand our model of the world, to almost test the models that we've got, and go out there and test a bit. So we start testing our love model, for example, by having, you know, our first kind of real relationships between this age. You know, your first loves, for example, starts to formulate at this time. We're influenced by our friends more at this time. And the values are picked up there. We're also influenced by more by rock stars and professional footballers and people like that. We look for the icons, for example, to be like. our individuality starts to form. You know, you may start to, you know, if you've got a significance model going on, then maybe you start to belong to a certain group at this point that fits in with your identity you've started to have. So if you're significance driven, I don't know, maybe one of the things you do is dress or style yourself in a particular way to fit in with the identity or to not fit in with the status quo. You know, maybe you become like a punk, for example, or you pierce yourself all over your body or start to have tattoos or these kind of things, just to start to experiment with your individuality. And that's the socialization period where we start to test out this family role model that you've been identifying with the whole time. And does this family model work out there in the real world? We start to test it out, start to get some experience back out there in the real world. Because after all, you know, it's this whole family unit that we've been a part of is essentially a people-making machine. Eventually, when you go out into the real world, we've got to see, does this thing work? And then you've got to start and find ways of adapting. If it doesn't work, then you've got to start and find ways of adapting. And then we move finally in our 21 to 35 years. This is an adapt. This is, doesn't come from Massey, actually. This is from James. This is our business persona starts to follow. So then, certainly in our culture at least, we start to fall into the corporate kind of identities. And we've got to try and make all this whole model now fit into a business arena as well. So, you know, because are there certain rules and to the game of business and corporate world, for example, all these other relationships and management structure to follow in. And now you're being managed by somebody, you know, and you're running your parent model against someone who's managing because they're in authority, for example. So your business persona starts to be developed as well through this age period. So there's just some very incidental things about how our, or big chunks, I suppose, and how our values are created. Yeah, let's do that next. Let's have a look at the evolution of values next. The evolution of values. Because this is particularly, I think, particularly potent. So our values are, to begin with, our first value that we're seeking to meet is survival. And our survival-orientated kind of mentality at this point, and this is denoted by the colour beige, if you're into colours, and this is your survival-orientated mode, where the only thing that you are interested in at this point is survival. Now, of course, some people do get, still even these days, get stuck there, in survival, or at least go back there at various times. And then we move on to number two, which is more our tribal kind of way, where we start to form the tribe. Actually, we just go on to our next slide. I think you might find that more easy to flip between the two. And there with our tribe, we do things because our honored chieftain says it's so. So we start to just do things because that's the way the person running the system says we better do it. And then we go to three, which is empire, aggression orientated. This is your Rambo. Remember the film Rambo? Yeah? This is your aggression orientated, and it's all about me. So because it suits me right now, right here, that's what's going on for me right now in the moment. And that kind of blows itself out after a while. We kind of get bored of that. We want to go to another level. So that's an active level. These things go between passive and active, these levels. So the first level we looked at, the band, if you like, the first level there, that is an active level because it's survival. Then we go into a passive state, which is more like we give up the control over to somebody else. Then we get fed up with that, we move on, then we decide to make it happen ourselves in an aggression-orientated way. And we realize that doesn't work. That's not working for us. So we go up to the passive hierarchy, system-orientated, which is denoted by blue color. And what we're doing there is passive hierarchy. It's more all about the system. It's all about the system because it conforms to the rule of the law. All religions are formed at values level four. All religions are values level four. Well, or most. There might be some that are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, it's about the system and it's about rules, and you will do this to obey. But it's a passive system. And then we move on to level five, which is a more active hierarchy. And we become more materialistic now. So it's a bit like level three, but level three, you're just running around barking at everybody. Level five is your achiever. So we go through that stage of being passive in the system, giving up our power, to taking back our power now and becoming more materialistic again. So this is your salesperson, your typical salesperson, for example. But, and again, obviously, you get businesses that operate here. Think about businesses here. See, some businesses are level three, aggression-orientated businesses. Some of them are values level four, passive. It's all about our customers, but forget about you. You're not important. You know, give everything up for some future gain kind of thing. And they run out of money, basically. Because religion's like giving things up today for, you know, for savior later on. Does that make sense? Yeah. And five is material organized. So again, we have businesses and people and individuals within organizations that are materialistically orientated, going to make it happen, do things, more come by me, you might stay at this stage from a kind of spiritual point of view. And of course, after a while, you know, some of us transform up and we go to the next level, which is our social network, group and cause orientated. This is the love the planet. This is your Greenpeace, giving up your own personal power again to the system again. But it's they're giving up the system in a good way. So your Green Party, thinking about everybody else and giving up the self, group and cause orientated. So management by committee. The Yes Group, for example, I'm not sure about today, but certainly in the past, the Yes Group, if you're familiar with that, runs as a Values 6 organization, which means that it's everybody there is there to have a hug. Everybody there comes to it to feel good. Everybody comes to think of everybody else and care for everybody else. But nothing ever gets done. It just stagnates because it's management by committee. So everyone's opinion is important, but there's no real focus and direction. Does that make sense? And businesses operate like that as well. Because we didn't like the active hierarchy, materialistic make it happen, for example. So, you know, we move to the next level, but that doesn't work either. There, that's not really useful either. So this works as well as individuals, as well as groups. Then we move to number seven. Seven's where we start to reconnect with the higher power again. We start to let it back in. We start to let in grace back into our life, and it's the functional flow. It's the most functional approach to running a business and to running yourself at a functional level without getting too into the clouds. Like I said yesterday, it's all very well having the experience of the other things, and I want to take you that far. You want to have moments like that, but you can't live there consistently and still be a human being. Unless you want to become a Buddhist monk and go and, for example, just meditate somewhere in the hills, you could do that. And if you chose that life, it would be great. But for most of us here in this society, level seven, functional flow, is about where you want to probably maintain most of your life being. And the functional flow means you consider all the others. You have all the other things going on. So you can. It means you can dip between any of the others at various times. You have now the choice to be any of the others at various times. You consider everybody else, the planet, and everything else you consider, but at the end of the day, you still make the decision. One of you still leads. Because in the world, Despite what some people might think, we need leaders to lead us. Not all of us can make the decisions for all of us. It doesn't work. We have to ultimately elect someone to lead. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. It's just chaotic. And we all have to start taking responsibility for ourselves, but ultimately, in, say, a business, in governments and things like that, we do have to ultimately give up and allow one person to lead, or a smaller subset of people to lead, for it to work effectively. But we allow everyone the ability to grow within it without feeling dictated to, for example, which is what you'd have further down in the values hierarchy. And then this next one up, the final one with Heather, is global flux, which is where you're connected to all things all the time and you're just totally in the one. So let's have a look at some values transitions now that I think you'll find particularly useful here, before we start working this at an individual level. So values transitions. I think it may be on your next page. Am I correct? Is that your next page? Do you have values transitions? Global flux. Yeah, global flux is the returning back to your oneness. So you're connected to all things all the time. So that's more into your sort of through me, as me stage. Spiritual connection, correct. So we've added a few more of these levels now. If you find the values transitions, we'll go through that now. So, first up, victim stage. In your victim stage, you literally are a victim. And to move on to the next level, which is understanding, that understanding gets you to the next level. If you're a victim, understanding that you are a victim begins to move you to the next level. And you move from the next level, from understanding that you're a victim, hurt and rejection is your next level. So you let go of the hurt and rejection. And that gives you self-acceptance. Then you start to accept what's happened and what you've been doing. And then, after the hurt and rejection, comes the guilt and the unworthiness. Guilt and unworthiness of what you've been doing to yourself and to other people, and feeling unworthy of anybody's love. So you start to, you know, pity yourself again. And what you need to do is forgive. What you need to do is move on to forgiveness, to forgive yourself fully. And that moves you on, noticing now you have unfulfilled expectations. You now realize what you've been missing out on. You now realize there's so much that you could be doing in life, and you feel a bit sad, and you start to realize these unfulfilled expectations are there. And you start to feel angst about it. And what you need to do is totally go with the flow. Totally go with the flow. Rather than focusing on worrying about what you haven't done and how much there is to do, is just let go of it and go with the flow. And that brings up social expectations on top of that. We now go to another level of all these social things that you could be doing as well. Social expectations. Expectations of other people that have on you as well. All these other pulls and pulls on you. And what you've got to do now is let go and be a leader. Recognize that you are a leader. And that you were born to lead. Everybody leads something. At the smallest level, you're leading you. And then you start to lead smaller groups, and then bigger groups. Ultimately, if you want to have the most influence in life and your life to have the most richness, then you want to find a way of leading the biggest groups. So you start to let go and become a leader. And then you start to have fear. Fear of your own power. Which is why most people won't get up and stand on a stage and do this. Because they fear of their own power. They start to realize just how powerful a person you are, and it scares the shit out of you. Most people who do this work that you and I are doing right now, when you get to a certain level, when you start to do your first kind of real interventions with people, and you start to become a real leader, and somebody changes dramatically as a result of something you've done with them, you really shit yourself. I'm seriously, you really, really soil it because you go, fuck. I can't be that powerful when it brings up all your stuff. Because one, it means you're that powerful, which means you've got no excuses left to hang on to any of your own stuff. And then you start to worry about, well, if I've got this much power, ooh, what if I fuck people up? What if I screw up? And you start to fear the power that you have. So you've got to feel the power and be the power. Be it. Become all powerful. Because that's who you are. You are the energy of power. So be it. So you become all powerful. And then you get afraid of sharing the power. I want to keep my power to myself. I don't want to let it go and allow others, because you fear that you'll become less powerful. Which moves you to your next level. Moving to understanding that you can't possibly ever lose the power, because there is nothing outside of you. There's nothing there. There's nothing to fear because there is nothing there to fear. Nothing. Nothing there at all to fear. So nothing to fear sharing. And of course, what happens then is you start to feel your own limitations coming up. You kind of find it difficult to accept those boundaries and limitations that there is nothing outside of you. So you start to feel limited in that. You can't break forward. You still can't really have that experience of there is nothing outside of you. So your own limitations start coming up again. Limited in the way you're thinking. Let go of that and step into the infinite in all. And then what comes up is the sadness that there is nothing actually out there. And all there is you. You start to feel lonely and sad that all this time, all that there is you. But then you remember the oneness that you are it all. All of it. You're everything. You're not on your own. You're everything. And that, my friends, is where we all once were. We all once were everything. But here's the challenge with being everything. When you were in that state, you were the infinite all. You knew everything. You were boundaryless in a good way. You were everything. But knowing that is not enough. When you were the infinite everything, the all, you yearned not to know it, you yearned to experience it. And so, you fragmented yourself to have this experience, so that you could be everything again and go through the journey again, all the way through, and then laugh at yourself and laugh at the absurdity of it all. I don't know why you'd want to do that. See how it all fits in? Can you see the archetypes there too? They're all there if you look. And that's the game. It's just the game. We're all playing the game. And we love the game. Don't you love games? That's right. So roll the dice. Play the game. Move around the board. Become who you are destined to be again. That's the journey we're all on. We're all born into victim. You have no choice. Except you did choose it. And some of us choose to be greater victims than others. Because you dared to play a higher game this time. And your soul's just yearning to be evolved at the highest chunk. That is what you're here for. For your soul to be experienced and grow. And you do that by growing and contributing so that other souls can come with you.